Welcome to Color and Ceramics, the podcast for ceramic artists who want valuable ideas about using color from leading artists and world-class experts. Here's your host, Bob Acton, a sculptor and ceramic artist who's fascinated with color and how potters, sculptors, and artists use color in their work. Tune in as he talks with his guests about color, techniques, and the impact of color on people and art itself.
Hi, I'm Bob Acton, and welcome to the Color and Ceramics podcast. Today, I want to introduce you to Susie Burstein. She's a Vancouver-based artist whose vibrant ceramic sculptures and paintings are full of storytelling, symbolism, and a deep love for art history, especially the role of women as both muses and makers. She started out making punky, brutalist pottery before diving into narrative portraiture, drawing inspiration from her travels across Europe and years of leading workshops in Greece. Her ongoing series, Ladies Not Waiting, brings powerful women like Frida Kahlo and Lenora Carrington to life in richly decorated, myth-inspired figures that celebrate creativity and self-invention. Susie's work is a playful, layered mix of ceramics and painting, each feeding into each other, and her art has shown across Canada, the U.S., Mexico, Europe, and Japan. She teaches young artists at Arts Umbrella, works from her studio in Vancouver's iconic Parker Street building, and is gearing up for a major solo show called Enchantress in 2026. So let's get to the show and welcome Susie. Susie, thanks so much for joining us on the Color and Ceramics podcast. I am pumped to have you here as a fellow Canadian. So welcome aboard.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to actually be meeting you finally. Yeah,
this is great. This is awesome. Now you're out in Vancouver and I'm in Calgary, Alberta, but we have never met. But I have been following you because I know that you do some sculptural work and do a lot of work with a lot of color in your sculptural work. So I thought it would be a great opportunity to talk about those kind of things. Where did you learn about sculpture? Can you tell us a little bit about your background and what got you here today?
Sure. I studied at Emily Carr, but my journey, I guess, started quite a bit before that. I didn't really ever think I was an artist as a child, although I loved Play-Doh and I loved sandcastles. I couldn't draw horses like other girls could do in their notebooks when they're in school. So I thought, oh, I'm not an artist, because you're born knowing how to do that, of course. And then I danced a fair bit as a kid. I loved tap dancing. And then I went to university and tried academia and didn't like that. But I had already gone to Europe when I graduated from high school and gone to many, many major museums and galleries. And then I left university and traveled to Greek islands and lived on Greek islands for 6 months on Corfu in Crete. And when I came home from that, somebody I'd met in university asked me if I would be her artist model. So I didn't know what that was, but I was comfortable doing it. And I guess I was good at doing it. And so it put me into art schools. So that's really what happened, is that I got to a lot of perks with the job, in that I could take any classes that I wanted to take. Cool. And I saw, you know, I did drawing and painting, I did dance, I did fiber arts, I did all kinds of things. And then I saw this pottery studio and they were throwing on the wheel and they're messing with clay. And I don't know why I thought I could do that. I had no desire whatsoever to throw on a wheel, but I really wanted my hands in clay. So I started taking classes, and then somebody, my instructor, asked me if I wanted to share her studio. This is in Toronto. And I did that for a few years and thought, I need to go to art school. And I originally applied for fiber arts or ceramics, and I got accepted at Sheridan College to do fiber arts. But my husband wanted to move to Vancouver to a farmhouse on the water. You know, those farmhouses on the water.
I do.
So in Vancouver. So anyhow, we ended up in Kitsilano when I went to the art school here looking for fibroids, which they didn't have, but they had ceramics, and I happened to have brought pieces with me, and I got accepted right away. So that's how that beginning of that began. And then it was at a time when Sally Michener was my instructor, and she was quite amazing at bringing other cultures to our attention through the most fabulous slideshows, so that we could see the whole history of ceramics and a broad, broad range, not just vessels, which is basically, you know, what was being taught and shown in Vancouver at that time, but of ancient cultures. She took us to Mexico on a trip. We saw ruin sites. We went to Frida Kahlo's house. We went to museums. Went to artist studios. It was like a mind blow. We went to little villages. We did all that. And that was kind of made me think about art and travel combined. And that was my biggest lesson from art school, was knowing about art and travel. So she also brought in some really interesting instructors for us who were like from California funk, which was very inspiring as well. But color was not a big deal here, and figurative work was not a big deal, and hand building work was not a big deal. And pretty much that's been true in this scene for years. It's changing, but you know, so a lot of it I'm self-taught, and a lot of it I've taken workshops in different places. I've given workshops in Greece. A lot of it, you know, online now, you can learn anything online.
Yeah,
It's really
totally.
great.
Yeah, it's really good. You and I were talking before we started the show about John Matsoulis Gallery in California in Davis, and how he's, I think it was around the COVID time probably, when he started doing the online workshops with many of the top folks around the world. And those are, along with lots of other folks, have produced some very cool learning opportunities.
Very, very, very.
Because it's expensive to travel, isn't it? Time-wise, money-wise, all those kind. I mean, the face-to-face when you're with somebody is better for sure. But the online stuff has really made it much more accessible and affordable.
Absolutely. And for years, you know, after I studied ceramic sculpture at art school, but then when I came out, I didn't have a studio that was big enough to do that. I did have a kiln and I did have a small studio space. So I started, and we also had a family. We started, you know, we had our little boys. So I started doing pottery work, like hand-built, colorful pottery that I could just, you know, stop and start as I needed to do that. And that was great. And then, you know, at a certain, and I had galleries all over the place, but at a certain point, it was like all that drawing that I was doing on the pottery was saying, hello, I want to be three dimensional, like make me, you know?
Yeah.
And so, so that's what happened. And that was a big revelation to just be able to do that.
Yeah. And so you're doing, I mean, you paint, of course, but and some other things, but in our context, in terms of ceramics, your real focus is on sculpture.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
And it
it
seemed.
Was on pottery, but not, I'm not doing that anymore.
Not anymore.
Yeah.
You have enough teapots in your house, eh?
I just actually can't do it.
Yeah. So you're into figurative sculpture as well, as least as I see your work. Can you tell us a little bit about your work and what's your thoughts behind why you do what you do and what you're trying to communicate?
Sure. Let's see where to start. Well, I guess in the most immediate work, let's say, starting in 2017, I was doing, well, actually, it starts a bit before that. So I'd say in 2007, 2008 kind of time period, I was starting to make large kind of mythical figurative pieces that were mounted on found really interesting columns and pedestals. And I actually built those figures on top of the pedestal. And the pedestals were very funky and very weird. So it affected, you know, what the figure was going to be that was on top of it. And I was just responding to that pedestal to create the form. And each of those pieces, you could spin it on the pedestal, and then you would see it differently from front to back. And those pieces were life size. They were about, well, like 5 to 6, 6.5 feet tall. And they were built in multiple parts, but on top of these pedestals. And they kind of, you know, referenced my travels in Greece and the pedestal, you know, being on a pedestal and columns and Greek columns and stuff like that. And those pieces were, they were a new kind of foray into color because they were glazed with underglazes and glazes. And they were also, I left areas that would be painted. And at that time, with acrylic paint and with iridescent paints and with some patinas, like kind of rusty patinas and stuff that looks like copper, like aging copper on rooftops. So there was that body of work, and I was working on a show of those pieces. And I was also working on a tap dance to dance, or where I would be dancing with those pieces in the show, which I had choreographed by this amazing dancer who lived, Jim Hibbert, who lives here in Vancouver, but he's been in like numerous Hollywood musicals tap dancing, but he lives here now. And so he choreographed that for me. And then we made it into a film, a short film that's on my website, because I realized I couldn't be tap dancing in person with these sculptures, you know, night and day while this show was on for a month. And I needed some way to be able to show that. So that was kind of all really awesome. And then simultaneously, I got a phone call or I guess an email, which was like at the beginning of that kind of stuff, having, you know, an online presence, asking me if I wanted to make work for the Latin Grammy Awards. And I, one of a kind pieces. And it was really a short time period and make a lot of pieces, and I couldn't do it. And then we started talking because I had just hung up these movie star pictures because I used to write to movie stars when I was a little girl and invite them to my house, and they would send me pictures. So, you know, she said, "Do you want to do the Academy Awards? You can do pieces, you know, less pieces for nominees for the Academy Award for Best Actor and Actress and Directors."
Oh.
So I did that. So that was awesome. And
Yeah.
that brought me back into pottery, and I did a series called Motion Pictures, like they were pictures, you know,
Yeah,
jugs,
yeah, yeah.
pictures, play on words. And that led to a lot of really good media and more galleries and things like that. And then I was kind of in the world of thinking about film and stars and my son was in the film business, and I watched the film Mamma Mia, and it took place on a Greek island. And I realized that that island was Skopelos, and that there was an artist residency there. So for the next 10 years, every other year, I was giving a workshop on that island for in figurative sculpture. And that took me, this is all a roundabout story, but that took me to traveling not just in Greece, but to like a different country each time I went in Europe. And going to those galleries and museums and places. And that really changed the work. And it really changed what my sculpture was going to be. So I was in Madrid on one of the trips, and I saw the Las Meninas painting by Velázquez, and kind of was awestruck by that painting, which is interesting because it's so realistic, and I'm so not realistic, but I just love the style of it. And him posing with his, you know, behind the easel with these ladies in waiting and all that that thing means, and learned that Las Meninas means ladies in waiting. And I started a series called Ladies Not Waiting. So that has been the kind of thrust of what's behind my work since 2017. And it basically started with looking at masterpieces by men, male acclaimed artists that I would see in Europe, and looking at who their muse was and what was the story behind the muse, and what did I think about the woman and the story that they were telling. And that was like really interesting research and fascinating and really fun to play with, making pieces that are about that. And then I thought, well, what about actually one of my favorite artists is Frida Kahlo, that I've loved since
Sure.
I went with Sally Michener to Mexico, way long time ago. So I did a whole series and had a solo show on Frida Kahlo. And that was really interesting because it made me realize that all the women that I was really, really interested in, like Frida Kahlo, Leonora Carrington, Leonore Feeney, Tamara Dalembica, like these artists, Artemisia Gentileschi, all of these artists have some kind of serious diverse like adversity in their life. Something is physical, emotional, political, something, has been a really difficult thing for anyone to overcome. And how did they do it? And how did they become fabulous artists, cultural icons, recognized in a man's world? Like, how did they do that? What was their life about? What's similar about how they have done things, And how does that relate to me? And how does that relate to my personal stuff, right? So that's the crux of what's behind my work is The Ladies Not Waiting, of which I'm now, I think I'm putting myself in that pantheon. And then as a part of that, I have a separate body of work, but it's not really separate. That's called Tsipora. And those are more like spiritual self-portraits of me, but they don't look like me, but they are about me. And Tsipora is my Hebrew name, and it means bird. And the bird, when I first started it, it was me, traveling all over the world and flights of fancy and freedom and, surfaces that brought in like surfaces on the sculptures that brought in the surfaces that are on the buildings that you see in Europe that are, decaying and so beautiful, or in Mexico. And then COVID happened, and I just couldn't do that work that was all about freedom anymore. But I realized that the other part of bird is nesting. They build nests and they hang out in one place, and they make babies, and they're nurturing and they're thinking and they're reflecting and rebirthing, that kind of thing. So the Tsipora pieces are about that, and they have shinier surfaces, like they look like porcelain but they're not, but white shiny surfaces, gold luster, mirrors, bit of pastels, flowers, birds, they're like that. So those two bodies of work are kind of coming together, and that's what my work is about.
Very cool. Thanks so much for sharing that. You were telling us about how you use a number of types of media, glazes, underglazes, paints. How,
Lusters.
yeah, like how do you think about that? How do you pick that through when you're creating a palette for yourself?
I don't know. I guess it's evolved over the last 8-ish years, because before that I was, on the pottery pieces, I was just using underglazes and glazes. And that was, and it's like once, like twice fired, say, right? Pretty simple. But that I when I started to do sculpture, I thought, no, because I've just done that so much, I can't do it anymore. So so I guess with the life-size muses, with those pieces, as I said, I still used underglazes and glazes. Then I would leave areas without anything, and then I would fill that in with cold surfaces, whether it was, paint or these rusty things and coppery things. But then that's not what's happened since. So since then, I took an amazing workshop, actually, that I would really like to say. I took an amazing workshop in San Miguel Allende from two incredible ceramic artists who you would know. One is Deborah Fritz, and one is Lisa, and the other is Lisa Clegg. And they did an amazing, amazing 5-day workshop that absolutely transformed my work and changed how I saw things. And one of the things I learned from them, this is just a simple thing that I learned from them amongst so many things, is using oxides, putting on oxide washes or washing it off, you know, and then using underglazes or slips on top of that, and then maybe having shiny areas, maybe not. So at that point, because I wasn't putting a clear glaze on everything, and because I was getting a sort of the kind of surface that happens where the oxides, regardless of the color, and there's so many colors that it can turn into, depending on what you use, you have areas that are flat. So that means, you know, you can refire many times. You can decide where you want shine, where you don't, if you want lusters, if you don't want lusters. But also, if I needed to, you know, a certain point, I'm not getting what I want, and I just want to get what I want, I would use oil paint, because I had already started oil painting on canvas. So, and particularly oil paint mixed with cold wax. And that's stunning. And also oil sticks. And that you can apply like makeup, you know. And I really like, you know, like it's very, very tactile. It's very on the surface. And personally, I only wear like, you know, bright eyeliner, you know, lipstick. I don't have anything that's on my face. But there's something really nice about doing that on your clay surface, you know, doing it on a figure that you've made, that's so personal and so gets me in touch with that character. And you don't have to keep it if you don't like it. It's not permanent, you know, you can get rid of it. So that's cool. And then also adding a like gold leaf. Like that's really beautiful to add to it. And then that also led me to add other materials to my work, you know, found objects. Yeah, a lot of found objects or personal kind of mementos. Like when I did the Frida series, there had been a show at the Victoria Albert of Frida Kahlo's private stuff that was uncovered, that had been kept locked up. So it had her prosthetics, it had her makeup, it had her pills, stuff like that, perfume, you know, all these kinds of things. And I realized that a lot of those things were similar to my mother's. And I had some of those things, like the same brand of lipstick, you know, just like so personal. And so I started to add those into my pieces, you know, and really, really connect why I was interested in Frida, not just visually, but what is it behind her? And how does that connect to my life and to my mother's life? And then adding, you know, those elements that were personal to the work. Yeah.
Well, one of
so
the
each
things,
piece is individual. That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, I get that. And I, one of the things that strikes me as I listen to you talk about your work and your journey, I think, in clay and your approach is that you do a lot of research. You're doing a lot of thinking and research and checking out in the world about a variety of different things. And that really then informs your work.
It does inform my work. It does. And it's, you know, I the longer I do it, the more clear I am. It's not like I know in advance.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know in advance. I know a few things in advance. I might know I'm doing a piece on, like right now, I'm doing a piece on Tamara de Lempicka. So, yes, I have read books. I've watched videos. I have pictures. But I don't really know what I'm going to do. Like I know if it's going to be a torso or if it's going to be a head with a neck as a starting point. I kind of work from an almost columnar starting point of, you know, and build out from that. So, but I don't really know. It's like I have all that stuff in my head and I have all the research I've done before that, you know, all the teaching I do for kids and what I draw upon in that way and my travels. And then I put on music like, you know, Frank Sinatra or some jazz or, you know, something. I put on music and I just get in the zone and I just work with the material. And then I just, and because it's all in there anyways, then I can just do it. Then it just comes out. It just comes out and comes out and comes out. And I'm just working away until it's like there's like a like a siren in my head, you know, that's like, ugh, this is wrong, you know. And then I just, and with clay, it's so easy. You just remove that part and put another part on until it feels like in the zone. It's just experimental and see what feels right. And it's like so magical.
Hey, when do you
Yeah.
know when to stop? Like you're describing, I'm thinking of what it might be like to work like you are, and you are very spontaneous, intuitive would be words I would use, and that you work your magic with the clay. How do you know when it's finished?
It stops bothering me.
What do you mean? Tell me more.
Well, because, I'm in that space, right? I'm in that zone. And then I might stop to look, I like to get outside of that, or something stops me. And at a certain point, nothing stops me. Like at a certain point, I just stop. At a certain point, it just feels right. Like I feel it in my body. When it's working, I feel the music, I feel a flow, I feel like dancing. I sometimes start to dance. I might start singing with the music. And then all of a sudden, it's like that alarm where there's like, I get a feeling in the pit of my stomach, like, ugh, like that, and then I just, so how do I know when it's finished? Is I don't get that feeling anymore. When I look at, I don't get the pit. Or I'll get like, this is enough for right now because I'm not really sure where it should go, but this looks like what I can do with the clay. And I'm not sure what's supposed to happen in that headdress or what's supposed to happen, with a hand or with some part of the body. And so then I'll fire it, and then I'll start, and then I'll have a few pieces that have been fired because I tend to work one piece at a time until it's ready to go in the kiln. And then make, say three or four more. And then I'm ready to work on the surface. And then when I'm working on the surface, I have to really think because I have so many things in my brain and in possibilities of how I could use those materials and what I'm not going to do, what I'm not going to do or I am going to do. And then once I've got that more figured out and start doing that, then something will come into, because I'm doing that, something will come into my head of what that piece still needs. Either it feels complete or it says, no, actually, I need, I need my mother's pillbox and some metal, coming out of the top of her head or something. I don't know what I think, but something, something like that. And I have a lot of stuff around my house and my studio. So I don't necessarily have to go out seeking anything because I am, kind of a good shopper. I'm really good at shopping. I really like shopping for things and from my travels and stuff, or fabric or, metal stuff that I find, or people give me stuff a lot of times. So I just start rummaging around, to see what I might have.
I know what you
Yeah.
mean. I've got quite a collection of coral and bits
Yeah.
that, from the ocean that I've picked up over the years, shells
Yeah.
and rocks, and so they all sit there, and I can reach over and grab something pretty quickly without having to think, oh my gosh, where am I going to find whatever it is that I might be looking for? So that's pretty cool. Now, I've
Yeah.
talked to folks when we've done these interviews, and some people have been practicing like in an intuitive manner, like you. Other people are much more planned, and lots of folks who are maybe junior starting off in this world of clay and have got the bug and they're addicted to it now, will be wondering how to start. Where should, if they're wanting to move into sculpture work like you, what would be a good path for them? Because the way you've described your path was that it's quite varied, right? From travel to reading to personal experiences. Where's some good places for people to start when they want to do some sculptural work?
Well, I guess it depends on sort of what age you're talking about. Like I do teach children, and I teach children starting at 6 years old at Arts Umbrella, and I teach them right up till they're 19 years old at Arts Umbrella here in Vancouver. So I have a group of teenagers because they're serious, right? The younger kids will do whatever project I'm giving to them. And it's a really broad range, including making Mona Lisa when you're 4 years old, like that's seriously. So and they put a lot of feathers on her. But the teens, they're pretty, they're focused and they really do want to learn sculpture. And they're in this special program. So where I start with them, and I think this is a good place for them to start or find a teacher for this, but where I start with them is what I'm interested in, right? Because I can teach that the best. And what I'm interested in, I can make it sound very universal. And then there are particular techniques that will take you to that place, which you can use for anything, right? Because, coil building, slab building. What happens if you use the coils instead of the slabs to come up with your form? How do you do that? So it allows them a lot of, it gives them technical knowledge, but it gives them conceptual ideas, right? And then it gives them a freedom to explore what they're going to do with that. And they can know that based on what feels good when they're doing it, what brings them joy, what feels playful, what feels like, oh, wow, I can see that happening, but oh, look what else is happening, and I can make that happen too. Where does that take my idea? So it's an open way of learning in that context. But if they're older and they don't have that opportunity, and if they don't have a particular instructor that they want to work with privately or someone of that bent, they can go to art school, obviously, right? But it's a lot of money to go to art school. I think they have to take a course somewhere.
Yeah, they have to
They
build
have to
tech. They
take
have to build some technical skills that you're talking
they
about.
have to they have to have to know that. Yeah. And they have to have a place to fire.
The other thing
They
that
don't
I've
have to
heard
have a
you,
big place.
the other thing I've heard you talk about is that they need to have and pay attention to a sense of joy within themselves, and that the work that they're doing, whatever that might be, comes from that point of joy for them.
Yes, and I also feel that, and this is something I do say to people, is, if you want to have your authentic voice, right, and that could take time to develop or not. You might have an authentic voice before you've developed anything, right? It's good to notice what you notice. It's good to notice, like I wouldn't say, oh, well, see what's going on around town and see, what you see in the galleries and see what you want to do, blah, 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 because that's already being done. And it may or may not really work for them. But really just notice what you notice. What are you drawn to? What makes you feel like, oh, how do they do that? I want to do that, like that. And then have material, whatever say we're talking clay, have that material and go somewhere where someone will teach you how to do that technically and have a kiln so you can have that happen and have a kind of color. Surfacing that's of interest to you because different places have different things that they offer, right? And put all of that together.
Yeah, very cool. Now, along that path that you've described, because I've been down that path too, like you, and there's often a struggle that occurs that we run into for one reason or another. Would you mind sharing a struggle that you've encountered in your artistic journey and what you did to overcome that?
Oh my God, I don't know, a struggle.
Or a
Well,
challenge, or,
part of the challenge is actually having my authentic voice and not fitting into a particular genre within my immediate environment, in terms of galleries, not in terms of public art spaces. I show tons. But commercial gallery situations. That's a struggle.
Yeah, so tell us a little bit
Another,
about that. Yeah.
well, I don't know if I want to.
No, but I don't, I mean, tell us about this notion of your authentic self and what that means and how the interaction with a gallery where they're wanting certain kinds of things to in their space, like how does that create a challenge?
It creates a challenge if if you're me and you feel intimidated by that and don't want to face rejection, that is the challenge. The challenge is not actually that I've knocked on every single door and they've all said, sorry, no way, Jose. That's not the challenge because I haven't done that. But I'll tell you what's really the challenge has been. The real challenge for me is writing about the work and putting it into the context that it needs to be. What I find challenging, and this I find challenging in certain gallery situations, is reading about the person and what their work is about and looking at the work and saying, I don't see it. I don't get it. And how can I talk about my work? Am I supposed to put my work into that kind of art speak when I don't relate to it and I don't want to do it because I don't believe in it. I don't like it. So that has been a challenge. And it has stopped me from applying for lots of things because, you not only have to do that, but you also have to do it in a certain number of words. The editing of that is very challenging. So I can talk to you ad infinitum or do a live interview. I can do that really easily, but putting it into words, I find very, very challenging. So I actually have recently hired somebody to help me write. And that is the best thing, one of the best things I've ever done. But you have to find the right person because I've done it before and it's not always the right tone or something. So that process has helped me to really clarify where I'm coming from and be able to put, when you say, all those thoughts and all those years and all that research and this memory bank, it's filled with so much stuff. It's very hard for me to distill and to put it into a contemporary context and to give it cleanly a historical context, right? And reference points that people can grab onto. That has been my biggest challenge. And I think that I have met that challenge by deciding to have somebody write about me who I value and trust and understands, actually hears my authentic voice and can verbalize it.
That's great. I think that recognizing areas within ourselves that we're not best at or that we don't like doing for one reason or another,
Exactly.
That still needs to be done,
Exactly.
can be a great opportunity for artists. And I think sometimes artists feel like they need to do everything. And
yes.
And so, I just had a plumber at my house. Now, I suppose technically I could have done what he did, right? But
right.
I didn't want to, right? So,
right.
And
right.
And so it was great to have him come by and do the work. And so really we should be taking those kind of that knowledge. We do that in the business world all the time. We
Exactly.
find our skill set and we find the areas that we're not great at, and we supplement that with somebody else who has got that skill set that we can marry up
Exactly.
with. Yes.
Exactly. And I think artists particularly feel that we have to do every aspect that is in the art world to do, right? Like you might think, well, I don't have to do the plumbing because I'm not a plumber. I'm an artist. I don't need to do that. It's not my area. But if you are an artist, if you're an artist and if you're a ceramic artist and you think, oh, I really need to learn glaze chemistry. Like I'm supposed to learn glaze chemistry, and this kind of glaze, I'm supposed to know how to throw on a wheel. And hand built, like that. You think, or write, I have to write about my work, I have to sell my work, I have to, social media my work, I have to do every, you think you have to do every single thing, build my own website, like, no, we don't have to do all those things. We don't, because it's all of those things are huge skills. And just making the work and putting food on the table, and maybe you're going to have a family. And you have to raise, and you're going to raise kids like me, like a lot of women artists haven't done that. I've done that. And I've done it with my husband, but, we've done that. It's so many things to do. And I also teach part time, and that's very engaging and wonderful. So you can't do it all.
Yep, I hear you. That's a great lesson for
people to take away from our conversation here today is to you can't do it all, and to really find out what you really like to do, and be able to learn those skills. One person who was mentoring me in town said, "Bob, you know, maybe you should try some encaustic wax on your sculptures."
Have you done that?
Yeah, for sure. But that took me down a whole new road, right? Of learning about encaustic wax and colors and heat and how to apply it. And, you know the story, Susie.
Yeah.
That really interested me, right? It caught my interest because I had been looking at encaustic paintings in art galleries, and somehow the two connected for me. But
totally.
other things. Not so much, right? And so let's go and find somebody else to do that who's got those skills there.
Exactly. And when you talk about joy, I mean, that's a real way to know what are the things that you're going to focus on and what are the things that you're going to hand off, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And, and you want to be joyful as much as you can.
Yeah, I think the art...
And bring joy.
The art world in lots of ways is tough. And so you're really vulnerable when you're doing your artwork, because really it's your essence of you that's coming out in the piece, right?
Yes,
and so
exactly.
that makes it a challenge. It's exhilarating and fun, but also challenging at the same time. For sure. Hey, Susie, thanks so much for joining us today. Mm-hmm. This has been an awesome conversation, and I really enjoyed talking with you and learning from you. And I now understand your work better. And so when I get on to your website and your Instagram posts and see what you're doing, it makes a lot more sense. So thanks so much.
Thank you so much. It's a real pleasure, and I'm honored that you asked me, truly.
And I'm honored you said yes. So thank you very much, and we'll catch up in the near future.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Okay.
Bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the Color and Ceramics Podcast with Bob Acton and his guests. Please help others find the podcast by subscribing to this podcast wherever you find your podcasts, such as iTunes, Spotify, Amazon Music, YouTube, or other podcatchers. And don't forget to give us a review. We'll see you next time.